Mention fairy tales and most of us can name a few, Snow White or Cinderella or Little Red Riding Hood. Actually, those are all examples of very old stories, stories that exist in many versions, in many cultures, all over the world. Why? That's just one of the mysterious things about fairy tales. Writer A.S. Byatt's been studying them, writing them, and writing stories about them for decades in her award-winning novel Possession, and most recently in The Children's Book. She told N. Strange Chimps that the magical stories we call fairy tales are some of the oldest and most powerful we have.
When the Brothers Grimm began to put together their collection of German fairy stories, they thought they were discovering the religion of the ancient Germanic people. But fairy stories are, in a sense, the opposite of religion. You don't believe them. You know you don't believe them. They're there in order not to be believed, and yet you need them. There are wonderful descriptions in, I can't remember his name, but a scholar who wrote a lot about Breton fairy mythology in Brittany, and he said we can no longer imagine the real dark in countries without lighting, where they saved the candles they had, and people would sit round the fire or they would sit in the dark, and outside it would be completely dark. And you kept your mind alive by telling each other stories. And the stories both frightened you a great deal and reassured you, always. They always do both. And that is what they all have in common.
What did you mean when you said that fairy tales to you as a child were more real than real life?
Well, I would sort of walk about and I would talk to the other kids in the playground and it would all be slightly dreamlike and I would wonder what it was, and then I would go home and I would get under the bed cover with a torch and I would start reading fairy tales and I would come into being myself, really. I was sort of alive. I loved the forests and the trees and the creatures and the beasts and the sun and the moon and the stars and the sea. And all those things were more real than people saying, "Can you not stand up straight, dear?"
Well, the very old fairy tales, the kind that we're talking about and that you weave throughout this book, seem to me to grow out of a kind of almost an animist view of the world, in which the world itself is alive and enchanted.
I think that's true. I think they do. I think at any moment in a fairy story, any stone or any tree or any bit of water may take on a character, may become alive, may have a temporary moral purpose. Things in fairy stories are always appearing and being extremely useful. You know, I will give you a magic knife. It will show you where to go. And then in the next episode, it's completely disappeared because you don't need it anymore. Things provisionally speak. And I think I inhabit a world rather like that anyway, which probably comes from having read all the fairy stories when I was little.
One of the main characters in your new novel is a children's book author, a writer of fairy tales. This is the Edwardian period, right? The beginning of the 1900s?
That's right.
What are the sorts of fairy tales that your character Olive writes?
They are her own. They're not like anybody else's work, and to that extent, they're my work. And she is a person who emanates from not only the working classes, but from the black mining pits in South Yorkshire, and has lost two members of her family in absolutely terrible accidents underground. And she's taken to writing fairy stories as a kind of way out of the intolerable nature of the life she was in. And she's writing this endless story called Tom Underground about a boy who loses his shadow and has to go on these journeys into the mines to find the Rat King who carried away his shadow.
She's writing that story for her own son. It has an unhappy effect on him.
Well, this is the problem I found with all the great children's story writers. I think none of them were really writing them for their son. They were all writing them for themselves. And the ones who wrote really happy ones were wanting to prolong their own really happy childhood, or in some cases to give themselves a really happy childhood that in many cases, when you read the biographies, they didn't have. The idea that Kenneth Graham was lovingly writing The Wind in the Willows for his only son, who was the sort of lucky boy to have received this wonderful fantasy story of these little animals in a wood living a kind of perfect pastoral life. It's simply not true. That boy went to school after school and beat up other children and was desperately unhappy, and finally was talked into Oxford by his father and went and lay down on a railway line and let a train go over him. Hmm. And if there was only him, that wouldn't be interesting, but there are several other children of famous fairy story writers. And at a lower and more comical level, look at poor Christopher Robin.
That's what I was thinking of.
Well, he behaved with extraordinary dignity. I mean, he did not wish to be Christopher Robin. And he steadily said he was not Christopher Robin and made himself a business. I think he calls himself Christopher Milne. Mm. And he has explained it as best he could, that being saddled with this was not what he would have wished for a life.
Well, and then it was at exactly this period that J.M. Barrie wrote Peter Pan, the story about the boy who doesn't want to grow up. And you set one scene of your book at the opening of that play. Must have been fun to imagine.
It was, and also if you actually read the accounts of the real opening, the play was much different and in much more bad taste. And he had a scene in it when all the lost boys come back from Never Never Land to London. And it's a scene of the beautiful mothers. And all these women come on stage, and Wendy, the little girl, tests them on whether they are the mother of one or the other of the lost boys by whether they would know what to do. You know, I can't remember the examples, but if he had a bad cough or if he couldn't find his shoes, you know, and would you kiss him better? And some of the mothers are rejected and some are accepted. And the Victorian critics, the Edwardian critics, thank God, said, this is not a good scene. It was cancelled. And the other thing about, it's an uncanny play, that, because the other thing about Peter Pan is that the American impresario whose imagination made it possible went down in the Lusitania and he said to somebody, I think this is even possibly not apocryphal, he handed somebody else his seat in the lifeboat and stood there saying, to die will be an awfully big adventure.
I mean, just like Peter Pan?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure he was making a joke, and it's a jolly good joke to make at the moment of seeing you're about to drown because you've gallantly offered your place to somebody else. And he was obviously a wonderful man.
Yes, but it's so creepy when you then think that the backdrop of all of that is that all those young children who sat in the audience for the first Peter Pan would wind up dying in the trenches in World War I.
Absolutely. It is. And indeed, Barrie adopted the children he had met, in fact, in Kensington Park. And when both their parents died, he adopted them. And the eldest of them died in the trenches. And there are some terrible scenes in Barrie's biography of him receiving the letter about the death of George and being simply unable to speak and never quite the same again. But that scene repeated itself and repeated itself and repeated itself all through Europe.
Are you suggesting in part here that some of the adults in your story and at this particular period of time fetishized childhood and the world of the children's imagination and tried to linger in it themselves to avoid growing up?
Yes, I am suggesting that. And I think they did it in very different ways and all of them differently. And they knew it in a way because there were articles published in Edwardian papers saying children's literature is actually the great literature of our time. Many of the most important books in the literature we are now producing were written for children. And one of the reasons they would give is, under Queen Victoria, everybody was a gloomy grown-up in a black dress with a white collar and a cap on her head. And now we are free. And then if they were very clever, they would say the freedom we've got is the kind of freedom English gentlemen prolong by eating nursery food in English clubs and going and stomping around on the moors and in the woods in their plus fours.
They created what many think of as the first golden age of children's literature. Of course, more recently, people have suggested we're living through another golden age of children's literature. Do you think we're living through a somewhat similar period?
I think we may be. I read certain books that are sort of partly for children compulsively. But I think the phenomenon of adults who read more children's literature than ordinary literature is saying something either about those adults or about the adult literature of the society they may find themselves in. It may be that the adult literature is has too little story in it, or too little life in it, or is too pessimistic, which I often think, you know, most of the novels you pick up, most of the good, in brackets, novels you pick up are not very cheerful.
They all seem to be about dysfunctional characters from dysfunctional families to whom dreadful things happen.
Yes, I'm reading Fame at the moment on my Kindle, and it is not cheerful. I am going quietly along with it, and the Kindle says to me I've got to 65% of the way through. And so far, nothing of any kind of cheerfulness has happened to anybody, and everybody uses the word depressed about themselves every third or fourth page.
No wonder we prefer children's books.
No, I'm not saying I'm not admiring it. I am in some ways, I think we need children's books because we need a way out. When we had writers like Sir Walter Scott, he wrote things like Rob Roy and Ivanhoe, and there was a lot of cutlass fighting, just like in Peter Pan, and people rushed across the moors. Or there were authors like Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Treasure Island and wrote Kidnapped. And it's hard to say whether those were written for adults or for children. They were tales written to be read and grip your imagination.
Well, you've made me want to get back to the library.
That's a good thing.
And Strange Champs talked with A.S. Byatt about her most recent novel, The Children's Room.